Good afternoon, good evening. Nice to be back with everyone in this group. We've been discussing at length the issues of civilian casualties in wartime in halacha. Sorry, one second. And today we're going to be speaking about, I think, what many ways, one of the most interesting events and debates that came up in halachic circles when it came to military ethics. It's not a very well-known debate, not a very well-known incident, but it's a really fascinating one. I think that the issues that we in the previous sessions, when it came to the debate over fighting terror with terror, so to speak, and the debate between the Haganah and the Etzel and the development of Tarat and Neshek, the purity of arms, excuse me, that's an issue that people know about. And certainly the incident in Kibia and the great debate that it spurred in Israel created a lot of public discussion, and it's sort of a well-known event. But the event that we're going to be speaking about today, which happens in sort of the beginning of what now is known as the First Lebanon War, 1982. At the time, it was known as the Operation Peace of Galilee. Then it became known as the Lebanon War. Of course, now it's known as the First Lebanon War. And it's a really fascinating incident. It will bring up again Rabbi Shaul Israeli, we spoke about last week. But also, I think the figure who, at the end of the day, having now written a book on Jewish military ethics and thinking a lot about these issues, if there's one rabbi who I think most engaged in the issues in the serious way, in a way which resonates with me, not necessarily agreeing with everything, but certainly resonates with me, that's Rabbi Shlomo Goren. Rabbi Goren, of course, is famous for being the first, well, he's famous for blowing the shofar at the wall, Western Wall, in 1967. Famous picture, of course. But he was the first chief rabbi of the IDF, and then ultimately becomes the chief rabbi of the State of Israel, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the State of Israel. He's a really, really fascinating figure. Doesn't sort of fit into any camps in a lot of different ways. And he writes a very extensive treatise on military halacha, much of which is related to the work he was doing in as the chief chaplain, dealing with Shabbat and Kashrut in the army, and sometime Erevin, whatever it might be. And then davening times, all sorts of issues, a ritual, if you will. There's some very interesting responses that he has about agunot and addressing issues of missing soldiers. And he himself, by the way, at times would go into battlefields to retrieve corpses personally, right? Do this, endanger himself in many different ways in order to address this issue. And he has some very interesting writings. Not as extensive as could be, but certainly some very significant essays on the issue of military ethics. And it's on this issue, of course, of civilian casualties, which is particularly interesting to me right now. Now, Rabbi Goren, I should note from the get-go, was a supporter, at least initially, of the Lebanon War, of the Operation Peace of Galilee. He publicly deemed it a Milchemet Mitzvah. And in fact, as the war goes along, pretty soon, actually, as the war goes along, there's some opposition to the war, including in rabbinic circles. The most prominent opponent to the Lebanon War, rabbinic opponent, well, in Israel became Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein, but at the time, probably the most prominent around the world was Lord Jacobowitz. Rabbi Jacobowitz was the chief rabbi, not Lord then, but chief rabbi of Great Britain. And at one point, it got so hostile that Rabbi Goren said we should put Rabbi Jacobowitz in Cherem. Okay, so you understand, right? It's a pretty, it becomes a very hostile and very difficult rabbinic discussion, let alone general political discussion as Israel moves along in the war. But the incident we're going to be talking about today is very much still in the earlier stages of the war. We're at a point We're at a point in which Israel is only in July 1982. Okay, so the war starts in June 1982, basically 1 year to the date of the famous raid on Osirak, right? And Israel, in order to remove the threat of terrorists from Palestinian terrorists, from the PLO, Yasser Arafat, from southern Lebanon, Israel's tried a number of different tactics, right? You might be hearing a lot about the Litani River these days and Hezbollah. So Israel tried to push back the PLO beyond the Litani in Operation 78, and that had short-lived success. And after a number of different incidents, a decision is made to enter Lebanon. I don't want to get into all the details here. It's actually of humongous ethical and political significance about what was agreed upon in the cabinet and how far they're supposed to go. Because it seems that the cabinet thought they were going to create some form of security zone or push back up to 40 kilometers, maybe 20 kilometers, further than what they did in 1978, but no intent of going full force into throughout Lebanon. The defense minister Sharon had different ideas. We'll get into all those debates right now. But what's clear is the reality is a month into the war, after Israel's had a difficult war already, moving up Lebanon and dealing with all of the dilemmas that's first encountering of asymmetric warfare, the dilemmas of the CNN effect, because all of a sudden now everything's being televised across the world. And so Israel lays siege on Beirut, in which Yasser Arafat and his henchmen are living. And a month into the war, this is going on. It's already creating the war a bit of controversy. And Rav Goren, who is the chief rabbi, right? I mean, he's not a insignificant position. He's the chief rabbi, and he's not only the chief rabbi, but he's a person who's well known as a military man, having spent over 20 years in the Israeli military. And Rav Goren declares that is an obligation of Jewish law. This is Rav Goren on the bottom right here. Obligation of Jewish law to leave the fourth side open of Beirut. That is to say, you cannot hermetically seal, which normally, of course, how sieges work. You cannot hermetically seal the city of Beirut, but you have to create a one-way evacuation corridor. Of course, he doesn't think you have to allow supplies and other armaments and warriors into the siege, but you have to allow people to leave. And of course, when you allow people to leave, some of them will be non-combatants, some of them could be combatants as well. But Rav Goren felt that was a bona fide law of Judaism, and he publicly states it is incumbent upon the IDF to leave a fourth side open. And there's a, I don't want to over-exaggerate the attention that's given to this. But there's certainly, it's covered. The statement is covered in the media and is discussed. And it raises some opposition, including that of the man on the top right here, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli. Rabbi Yisraeli is the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav Yeshiva, a very prominent yeshiva in Yerushalayim. He's a member of the Beit Din HaGadol, the Supreme Rabbinical Council of the Chief Rabbinate, a figure of real standing. And Rav Yisraeli, who we saw last week, right, writes about this, says to Rav Goren, "What are you talking about? And there's no such thing as leaving the fourth side open in a siege when you're dealing with a Melchemet Mitzvah, when you're dealing with a war of defense or a war of conquering territory of Eretz Yisrael. No such obligation." And while he says it is true we should try to allow non-combatants to leave, he does believe that to be the case, Rabbi Goren nonetheless is, excuse me, Rabbi Yisrael is very insistent that there's certainly no general obligation to leave a fourth side open, which of course can allow combatants to flee as well. And he says, look, the nature of siege warfare, which is accepted and utilized throughout history and even in current times as well, siege warfare means a siege, right? That's what it means. You don't let people out. That's exactly how the tactic works. And part of the logic of the tactic is instead of fighting, you try to get people to right, to give up. And it prevents actually a lot of bloodshed in that respect. And either way, sieges are certainly permitted. There's no obligation to leave a fourth side open. So I want to start with this because you see here two figures, great rabbinic stature. Both of them, by the way, are on the political right, right? So they're both on the political right. Nonetheless, have a real dispute over this matter. Now, keep in mind, let's recall we saw last week from Rabbi Israeli. Rabbi Israeli, we discussed last week, was a believer that halacha only mandates whatever is accepted by the nations of the world. Right? You may recall he has this idea that dina de malchuta dina, this notion that convention of whatever is decided by the state also applies on the international level, not just the national level. And Rabbi Israeli says whatever is accepted as ethical restraints on warfare is what halacha demands as well. So let's think about applying that in our circumstance. Are sieges allowed in the international affairs? The answer is yes. By the way, even today, I mean, a lot of just war theorists have a hard time with it, but under international law, sieges are certainly allowed, right? I mean, it's the classic method of warfare. And so you can understand Rabbi Israeli saying is, what, why should there be anything beyond this notion? Excuse me. Why should there be anything beyond this notion of what's accepted in the world? Whatever is accepted in the world is what we have to do. The world allows a hermetically sealed siege. So where is Rabbi Gorin coming from? Okay. And so this is precisely what I want to get to here a little bit. And excuse me. And to think about for a moment, just to recall that what I established last week or 2 weeks ago. You recall a couple of weeks ago, I try to lay out some general principles of Jewish military ethics. And if you think about that in this context, so let's think it through for a minute. Sieges are meant to win wars, right? They're meant to pursue justice. They're meant as a collective affair. There's nothing greater than a collective affair than you're saying everyone in that area is going to be impacted by this siege. We're going to surround people on it. And it's clear that one of the things that Rabbi Gorin is trying to do is to say that, well, even when you have this collective affair, even when you're trying to favor your side over the other side, which means that the collective, the enemy collective is going to suffer, nonetheless, even in this moment, in the name of remembering that all humans are created in the image of God, in the name of remembering that we don't want to just have any form of collective punishment, as it were, therefore, we believe in individual responsibility, therefore, we should allow people to leave. And the question is this a viable idea of some form of hermetic, of allowing this fourth side open? So I want to now make a claim to you, which I cannot prove. Okay? What I'm going to say right now is true, but the connection to what I've just said until now might be utterly disconnected. Okay? Obviously, I believe they are connected. Otherwise, I wouldn't be just giving you, random, nuggets of Torah wisdom here right now. But I want to discuss a little bit of the history of siege warfare in the Masorah and the incidence of sieges throughout Jewish history. And make a claim that this is going to impact how we view sieges and where Rabbi Gorin is coming from. Okay, so if you look in the Torah, oh, that's not the Torah, here we go. So you'll know that sieges are well documented in the Torah. And in fact, the one passage in the Torah which gives some form of restraint on warfare is precisely in the context of a siege, right? We're talking about in Devarim here. When you're war against a city, you have to besiege it a long time. And sieges are difficult. Let's keep in mind, it takes a lot of resources to be able to lay a siege because you have to have all these soldiers surrounding it, preventing supplies from coming in. You've got to keep them occupied. You have to have them have supplies. It's not so simple to lay a siege. And you could say during that period you can be very destructive while you're waiting outside, so to speak. And so the Torah tells us, don't destroy the trees. Right, there is this notion, right, of saying that you shouldn't not have a scorched earth policy, if you will. Okay, and in particular, there's concern for fruit-bearing trees, right? But in general, here, that which it can be destroyed is that which is needed for the war, but otherwise, do not destroy everything. In other words, the first time we have any form of restraint, restriction, and warfare comes up in the context of sieges. But most of the time, and we see in Chaz, the rest of Tanakh, we see the Israelites, B'nai Israel, do sieges. But most of the time, actually, we see sieges in which we are suffering. Okay? Now, let's keep in mind, both in Bayit Rishon, Bayit Sheni, First Temple, Second Temple, and in the fall of Beitar, the Jewish people fall after sieges. In fact, we have a holiday, a day that's commemorated on our yearly calendar, a fast day, which is all about the siege and all the bad things that happen from the siege. That fast day is Asara B'Tevet. They were told in Divrei Yamim and in also Melachim Bet that the siege is laid on the first temple on Asara B'Tevet, and it's very significant. If we're going to have fast days for the days the walls are broken, for the days that the base of Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, what are we having a fast day for the beginning of the siege? And the answer is the Jewish people suffer greatly from this siege. And so if you take a look in Eicha, particularly in Eicha Perek Dalet, you'll see the very vivid descriptions of all the suffering that goes on during the siege, right? So the gold is dulled, debased to finest gold, right? The sacred gems are spilled. Could be the gems are spilled because it's a metaphor here, or because it's nothing to do with that money, right? What are you going to do with the sacred gems? Once valued as gold, they are counted as earthen pots. And we have this description of the poor even turning, the poor people have become cruel, right? They're so hungry, they're thirsting for hunger. Little children beg for bread, but no one gives them a morsel. People that once ate fancy food now are either living or dying or picking from the garbage heaps, right? The refuse heaps, right? Which is a terrible description. People have lost all color in their faces. Their bodies are no longer recognizable. Their faces are blacker than soot. They are not recognized in the streets. Their skin is shriveled on their bones. It has become dry as wood. Here comes a very dramatic statement. Better off were the slain of the sword than those slain by famine. Meaning, it would have been better off for people to have just been killed at the get-go by the sword than to suffer and die slowly from famine. And to the point we get to the even women are cooking their own children and eating the flesh. Okay? It doesn't get worse than that. And so in Eicha, we are told how Jews suffer so greatly from a siege. And the same thing happens in Bayit Sheni as well, times of the Second Temple. We have this a little bit referred to in Chazal, but Josephus, famous Roman historian, describes this as well. And in Josephus' book 6, he's describing here a incident where once again Roman soldiers discover a case of a woman killing her children and eating the flesh and offering them half of the flesh, as it were. And the story sort of shakes the Roman soldiers who are laying siege on the city. And they say as follows: this sad instance was quickly told to the Romans, some of whom could not believe it, meaning some people said, I don't believe this story. This is so crazy. And others pity the distress which the Jews were under. And some Roman soldiers said, wow, that's really bad what's going on there. Like, we sort of feel bad about that. But there are many of them who are hereby induced to more bitter hatred than ordinary against our nation. Others just hated us and they didn't get bothered by this one bit. What did Caesar say about this? So Caesar excuses himself before God on this matter, and he says, listen, it's not my fault. The fact that they're eating their children is not my fault. I proposed to them peace and liberty, meaning I told them surrender. But they chose war and sedition. They could have had abundance, but they chose famine. Meaning, I gave them the opportunity not to go to war, and they nonetheless decided to go to war. And therefore, whatever happens now, once the war has started, is their responsibility. Meaning, what Caesar is arguing is an interesting argument in general, which we could say is, listen, we'll do everything we can to avoid war. War is a war option, last resort. But once war begins, we don't have to care anymore about the suffering that goes on in that nation. That's not our business. That's not our problem. And you could ask, well, okay, well, that sounds like how sieges work a lot. Is that indeed our perspective on this issue? Okay. So let's think about this for a moment, because you could say we have a parallel in Jewish thought of offering peace. And then you could say, okay, but once that happens, all bets are off. So it pays therefore to take a look here and see a little bit about what we say on this. So if you take a look once again in Dvar, we are told about this notion of offering peace. It is not clear that we always have to offer peace before going to war in the Torah. You might have said, in fact, that it only applies in Milchemet Rishut, in a discretionary war, or an optional war, or an expansionist war, different ways of interpreting it. I discuss this at length in the book, right? But you could say that offering terms of peace is only required in certain circumstances, but the Rambam and others assert that whether it's a Mechamet Rishut, expansionist war, or discretionary war, or a Mechamet Mitzvah, conquer the land, you always have to offer peace. Peace, you should understand, is a surrender, meaning it's not like it's just like kumbaya peace, right? But it's trying to say we can avoid going to war. And the Medrash, one Medrash, has a very interesting rendition of this story. And the Medrash tells us a really remarkable passage where the Ribbono Shel Olam tells them, Lo techanem, right? Go destroy them. Destroy these people. And Moshe Rabbeinu says to them, says to God, how am I going to go and smite all of them? I do not know who has sinned and who has not sinned. Meaning, what is Moshe Rabbeinu saying? How can I go and kill the entire nation if I don't know all these people that I'm going to kill have actually done me any harm? Maybe they haven't sinned at all. Why am I doing this? So instead, in order to avoid killing the guilty, the innocent with the guilty, what does Moshe Rabbeinu say? I'm going to first come to them in peace. And Moshe says, okay, Hashem, excuse me, says to Moshe, I told you to destroy them, but now, just as you want it, so I will do. And the law becomes that you have to offer peace, which means that war becomes a last resort. And that's a very, fascinating state comment and story in its own right in the Medrash. But this question still remains. Once you've gone to war, once surrender's been rejected, once the offer's been rejected, do we then have to care about those people as well? So there's a very, very fascinating passage in the Sifri, and it's on a commentary on a psukim about the war against Midian. And all it says here is that the Jewish people go against Midian. We don't know how they go against Midian. We know nothing about it. It's just a very simple statement in Bamidbar. Now let's recall, in the war against Midian, the Jewish people go and kill everyone, right? And then when they come back with the women and the children, what does Moshe say? You came back with people. Kill them too. This is not the passage in which you would expect to be learning restraints and restrictions on warfare. And yet, let us see what the Medrash actually says on this parsha. So the Medrash brings down a statement of the Chachamim, seemingly, who say that they surrounded on four sides. I mean, the Chachamim just assume this must have been a siege, and the siege was on all four sides. But Rabbi Natan says they left a fourth side for them to flee from. They kept the fourth side open. So it seems to be we have a machloket between the Chachamim and Rabbi Natan. Who do we paskin like? Both the Rambam and the Ramban say we paskin like Rabbi Natan. When a siege is placed around the city to conquer it, Hilcha Malachim and Perek Vav, it should not be surrounded on all four sides, only on three. A place should be left for the inhabitants to flee and for all those who desire to escape with their lives, as it is written, and they besieged Midian as God commanded Moshe. So the Rambam passes like Rabbi Natan, and the obvious question, of course, is where did he get Rabbi Natan get this idea from? Right, where is this coming from? And the Rambam says in Piyashmua, according to tradition, meaning there's no indication in the text of this, is me Piyashmua. Now, that's a very fascinating statement because it goes against the thrust of siege warfare. It goes against the whole thrust of the passage, which seemed to be that we didn't really were so careful about avoiding civilian casualties. But nonetheless, that is how the Rambam paskens, and it gets even more interesting. Because you ask, well, what's the logic behind this? And Rabbi Natan, excuse me, the Ramban, I mean, what's the logic behind Rabbi Natan? And the Ramban says there's two elements. A, we learn from here that even in the midst of a war, we should have compassion, rachamim, what you might call a humanitarian argument, if you will. And two, there's also a strategic element, because let's think about it. If you have a siege, what are the people inside going to say? Well, we got no choice. We might as well fight. And they're going to fight to the bitter end. But if you have a situation in which the people could say, wait, maybe we don't have to fight. We could flee for our lives. If you give people the option of flee for lives, they'll leave. What happens if they leave? It becomes a lot easier to conquer the city. And so what the Ramban is saying is that there's two elements to the keeping the fourth side open. There is, on the one hand, the humanitarian part, compassion towards enemies. On the other hand, it's also a strategic advantage. Where did Rabbi Natan get this idea from? So if you look in the Tosefta Gepshuta of Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, he speculates that Rabbi Natan lives in the 2nd century CE, and he speculates that he learned this from some Roman thinker, strategist, who actually suggests this idea. I did a little bit of research on this for the book, and we see actually that, you know, most Roman strategists, felt we would just, you know, lay sieges like lay sieges, four sides, right, to be decisive. But there are a couple of writers who do discuss this idea of leaving a side open so that way people flee and abandon the city, which will make it easier to conquer. Could be. But I have a different idea of where it comes from. It's not really clear to me. Is Rabbi Natan hanging out with Roman strategists in order to learn military strategy, right? I could be. No, he hears it from the, I don't know. It's possible. But I think there are other possibilities as well. So if you look at Rav Simcha Kohen of Dvinz, the Meshech Chochma, the Rosh Sameach, beginning of the 20th century, and his commentary to the Rambam, so he says, a comment on this passage, excuse me, in Torah, he says that Ramban learned this idea that just as we have to offer peace, so too do we have to leave a side open so they can save their lives. In other words, the Ramban says that this too, the people of Moshe Rabbeinu, is to minimize the loss of lives of others. And what the Rambam and the Ramban are then coming to teach us is it's not just a matter of before the war starts. Even once the war does start, you got to go and try to save their lives, or at least give that possibility of saving lives. I think it's a very fascinating answer. And if that's the case, let's go back to my set of principles here. Because I think this would be a great example of how you could have halacha, which is trying to balance different values. On the one hand, we want to destroy the enemy. We want to settle the homeland, or we want to defend ourselves, whatever we're going to war for, whatever the reason is. And we understand that's a collective affair. We want to say we want to win. But even in that moment, We offer a peace beforehand. And even in that moment, when we've gone to war, we still try to minimize those casualties by allowing them to flee. Keeping in mind that there's a balance between the strategic element and the humanitarian element. And part of the argument is here is that when they both go hand in hand with each other, that works out great. And so that it seems to be an incredible teaching, but I have a different theory. When did Rabbi Natan live? Rabbi Natan, we know from other places in Chazal, is originally from Bavel and comes to Eretz Yisrael around the time or soon after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. This was early 2nd century CE. I cannot prove what I'm going to say to you right now. But imagine you are a 2nd century Tana who now has seen what happens in the horrors of siege warfare from Bar Kokhba, from Beit Sheni, and Beit Rishon. Is it possible that Rabbi Natan, who understood the Jewish experience of siege warfare, might have been suggesting that if the Jews ever get power again and they're able to lay siege, they should do it differently than our enemies did it. And they should try to win those battles, but when they're trying to win those battles, they should avoid the type of suffering that we had where women were forced to kill or eat their own children. I cannot prove to you that this is where Rabbi Natan gets this idea from. It could be a guy from the Romans, Roman strategist. It could be he derived it from, like the Meshech Chachma says, from the peace offering. It could be it's just a Shmua tradition, like the Rambam says. But I have a feeling that's not a coincidence that someone who saw how Jews suffered from siege warfare would try to say, let's make siege warfare a little bit more humane if we ever get power. And of course, we didn't have to think about this issue for many, many, many centuries. Because Rabbi Natan gives his ruling in the 2nd century, the Rambam and the Ramban, Paskin like him, and the 11th, the 12th century, 30, whatever may be going on. And when does this have to be implemented? When does this matter? And I think the answer is, I mean, we can think about it a little bit, right? There are other cases. But more or less, the next time this issue comes up, 1982, Beirut. And the question now becomes, do we really actually have to leave the fourth side open? Or, as Rogorin said, or would we say, like Rabbi Israeli, that we should try to minimize the civilian casualties, but when push comes to shove, you don't have to leave the fourth side open, and you certainly don't have to do anything that will allow combatants to flee. Okay, so having now gone back to this debate, what happened in Beirut 1982? Did the IDF follow? They weren't following these positions, but in practice, did they do what Rav Gorin said? You have to have an evacuation corridor? Or did they do what Rabbi Israeli said? No need for that whatsoever. Answer is they did what Rav Gorin suggested. Okay? And this is very remarkable because I want to show you, I don't know if you can see this in my, wrong side. Just and Unjust Wars, right? A famous, famous book by the philosopher Michael Walzer. Undoubtedly, in many ways, the most influential book of military ethics in the past 50 years. And he quotes, he's Jewish, Walzer. He knows the Jewish tradition quite well. And he quotes the Rambam and this idea of the fourth side open. And he says on this, he says, the sentence of saying that you have to leave the fourth side open, that you surround a city on three sides, such a sentence could only appear in the literature of a people who had neither a state nor an army of their own. Meaning, what's Walter saying? This ain't that realistic. You can't leave the fourth side open. It is an argument offered not from any military perspective, but from a refugee perspective. Okay? In other words, what is the Rambam saying? It's the type of thing that you would say if you're in Gullus, but there's no applicability to this. But the answer is, and Walser understands, there's a principle that we get from this. And the principle, of course, is that we should try to minimize the hardship caused even once the warfare begins. And so that indeed is what Israel does. Let me just pull this up now. And you'll see here that what happens, 100,000 people flee through the two evacuation corridors. And ultimately, there's a Reagan administration as a negotiation. And ultimately, many terrorists also leave Beirut. And if you look at the numbers, it's very interesting. The number game is always complicated. It was particularly complicated. You know, like today, can you really trust Hamas's numbers? Who knows, right? Their medical system, right? But in Lebanon, in Beirut, the head of the Lebanese Red Cross was Yasser Arafat's brother. Not exactly going to be the number one reliable source, right? So it's hard to know exactly the numbers, but there's a lot of investigation done in. You can see Richard Gabriel wrote a very good book called Operation Peace of Galilee. And through various different ways, he speculates that about 5,000 non-combatants were killed, with another 20,000 to 30,000 wounded. Okay? And you have about 1,000 PLO fighters they killed. Now, keep in mind, according to the UN, it's usually 1 to 9 in warfare in general. So 1 to 5 is actually not bad. But let's keep in mind other factors, because this is very remarkable. You would never see this today. But a head lawyer of the International Red Cross, Louise Doswald Beck, wrote 5 years later about this and said the Israeli bombardment of Beirut in June and July resulted in high civilian casualties, but not necessarily excessively so, given the fact that the military targets were placed amongst the civilian population. In other words, the core evacuation corridor method worked and got many people out, so it was extensive casualties, but not excessive. Especially because the terrorists were using their own people as human shields. No one from the Red Cross is going to say that today, right? And by the way, just do the numbers. Let's say Hamas is telling the truth, 25,000 people dead. Let's assume the IDF's got it right, right? If Hamas gets it right. Why can't IDF? You got 9,000 Hamas fighters dead. Do the numbers. Unprecedented low rates of non-combatant deaths. Okay, but that's 2024, but this is 1982. And here's another statement from Trevor DuPuy and Paul Mortel. And they're non-Jews, right? These are Americans who were actually in Lebanon during the war, military historians. DuPuy is quite a distinguished one. And they write as follows. As military historians, we can think of no war in which greater military advantages were gained in combat in densely populated areas at such a small cost in civilian lives lost and property damaged. Meaning the military advantage was gained. We can think of no war in a way in which it was gained in densely populated areas at such a small cost. And this despite the PLO's deliberate employment of weapons in civilian communities. Which is actually a pretty remarkable statement. And this is not a Hasbara book. Right, these are two historians. They call the book Flawed Victory because Lebanon War was a very flawed war. Right? But they're very, very, their statement, right, is here is very telling. And indeed, Rav Gorin would write later on about this issue that he thought it was a great Kiddush Hashem that the IDF leaves open the evacuation corridor. But here, the story gets complicated, the plot thickens. Because there are two sieges in the First Lebanon War, 1982 in Beirut, but also 1983 in Tripoli, not Tripoli, Libya, but Tripoli in Lebanon. And here, Arafat and his men leave Beirut in 82 as part of the deal that the Reagan administration makes, and they come back and are now surrounded in Tripoli in 1983. And in this case, though, it's not Israel that's fully surrounding. One side is being surrounded or being guarded by Arab rebels against the PLO, people who think the PLO is not radical enough. Okay, imagine that. Right. And so Israel actually does have a siege here because, like today, for example, Israel doesn't have a siege on Gaza. There's a fourth border that's controlled by a different party. And so too, during that time, now it's Egypt, then there's a fourth side controlled by a different party. And Rabbi Gorin says there's no requirement to leave an evacuation corridor. And you're like, wait a minute, what's the difference? Last year, you said there's an obligation. That's why they got out of Beirut in the first place. Why is there no obligation in Tripoli? Particularly if you're taking into account the humanitarian factor, right? Having compassion. Now, you could argue that once they left and came back, you only get this option once. And Rav Gorin's answer is more technical, though. He says that, well, because we don't have full control of the situation, we don't have obligation to leave open fourth side because we don't have a siege here. So the obligation of the fourth side never kicks in. There's no chiyuv, as it were. I find that to be overly technical. And I think what ended up happening here is that Rav Gorin wanted to make the fourth side option open, imperative, into a bona fide law. And I think that what the fourth side option is teaching us, fourth side open option is teaching us, is not a bona fide law. It's a principle. It's a value. And the principle is that even when you're laying siege and want to defeat that enemy, try to do what you can in order to minimize that damage. The same way, by the way, that the Torah tells us you can't cut down the trees. But Chazal say you can cut down the trees if it's needed. Just if it's not needed, don't cut down the trees. What were Chazal doing? They were balancing values here. On the one hand, we want to win and need to win. On the other hand, we want to minimize the damage. In that case, it's ecological damage. In this case, it's human damage. Either way, the principle is the same. Do what you can in these circumstances. And so, the question is, Rav Yisraeli right or Gorn right? The answer is that this is not a halachic imperative. This is a imperative of principle. And I think what the Rav Natan established ultimately gets established for us is a very, very important principle, which is trying to help balance the values that we've seen in the past couple of weeks in order to make this warfare to be as encompassing of these competing values, right? And to make that as humanitarian as possible, but without keeping in mind that there's also a moral imperative to defeat the enemy. And I think that ultimately is a great lesson. Now, when I discussed this a couple of weeks ago, I discussed it with a group of, I don't know, sophisticated yeshiva bachurim. And I gave them this theory, and they're like, what's a value? It's a principle. There's either halacha and psak, or there's, nothing. What's this imperative of a principle? And I said back, I see Rabbi Koben's laughing here, right? But, you can imagine this situation. And I'm looking at these guys, I'm like, well, don't you want Jewish law and thought to be encapsulate values? And they're like, values are fickle. Values can be applied in a lot of different ways. We need bona fide law. And I said back to them, well, maybe sometimes in life, you don't want bona fide law because what you want is values and principles, which you're going to have to figure out how to apply in these different circumstances. And this gives you a little more flexibility for that because you have competing values. And so to say that you have some form of bona fide law, you have to keep the fourth side open. Is that really true? I don't know. So that bothered them a lot. And I really egged them on even more when I said to them, and by the way, I think this is true about many other areas of Jewish law and thought, like end of life care, which I deal with in my day job, right? And other areas where you might have a lot of values, but not always bona fide rulings in some circumstances. So I think that that formulation needs to be thought through and the implications of this, but this, I think, is the consequence of not having precedent for many centuries. You have a situation where we don't have precedent. You have this one statement of Rabbi Natan, which has brought down halacha, but has never applied in practice for many, many centuries. And the question then becomes in 1982, is this actually relevant or not? And I think the answer is, yeah, it's relevant. But it might not be relevant as a bona fide legal requirement. As like the same way you have to have 40 sa in your mikvah, right? Measurements of a mikvah. But it w is relevant in terms of the values and principles that get established here. And in my mind, I think Rav Goren was very inspiring in this matter. And this I'll conclude, which is that Rav Goren was really saying is that we have these ideas that emerged that are trying to teach us these values and balances, and it's important to bring those into play. My only issue is that if you're going to say that's true in Beirut, why don't you want to say it's true in Tripoli? And I think the answer is he gets a little bit caught there. I mean, he gets a little bit stuck there. And I think you can get out of getting stuck by understanding that there is a general obligation to try to let people flee, but there are limits to that. And the question always is going to become is, right, when do you make, right, how do you apply in different ways? And that's why reasonable people can think reason, have different perspectives on the balance of these values. So just take the example. Was Israel right to create evacuation corridors in northern Gaza? I mean, you can make arguments in both ways, right? You can make arguments in, and to say yes, that's allowed a lot of people to flee. Or you could say it also probably allowed Hamas fighters to flee. Maybe some captives were taken out from northern to southern Gaza. Right? That's going to be reasonable. People can disagree on those issues, but I think that what halacha does provide us here with is a framework for thinking of these types of issues. And that, I believe, is a tremendous gift. Okay, I'll take some questions here. Gershon Hepner. Hello, Gershon. Nice to see you. So Gershon asks, do you conflate values with ethics? So it's a good question. I think that what I'm trying to argue is that the ethical framework, right, is made up of different values, each of which can have, we can appeal to. And what the decisions have to be made is when you have a multi-value framework for ethical decisions on a case-by-case level, you're going to have to decide which values you apply in this circumstance or which trumps the other values. My father, Zichrono Livracha, was a philosopher. I like to call this pluralistic casuistry. That is not a good brand name. Right, but I'll explain what this means by pluralistic casuistry. Casuistry is case by case decision making, where you're going to apply in certain circumstances. And what means by pluralist here is that you have plural values. You have multiple values at stake that you could appeal to. And this is in distinction to other philosophical systems, ethical systems, in which they say that you have to prioritize one value as supreme. So international humanitarian law today, international military law, the way it's understood certainly by many NGOs and other factors is that there's one supreme value, human rights, and you never have the right, never have the ability to violate someone's individual human rights. I don't think that's true. I think that all ultimately is going to have to be balanced by other types of values. And there'll be some who say the only value that we care about is winning, or the only value we care about is destroying the enemy. Now, that's certainly a very important value in terms of self-defense. But doesn't mean you don't also take into consideration other values. And I think that's precisely what Rabbi Natan's teaching, why it was so powerful. So Gershon, I developed this more in chapters 8 and 9 of the book, but the idea that I try to develop here is I think this is true about halacha in many circumstances, many different realms. But certainly in this realm is that we have here a series of values for which we can appeal to in different ways. And then we're going to have different disagreements about what the conclusion is. But those who take into consideration these values on a serious level are able to say they're making a statement that is based on Jewish ethics.
There is an opinion that there is no such thing as Jewish philosophy, and I'm wondering whether we should say the same about ethics. There's no such thing as Jewish ethics.
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't remember if we discussed it last week, but Leibovitz in that essay that Ishai Leibovitz, right, that essay that we discussed last week, makes that claim. And he says, listen, the whole point of ethics is to say that it is binding on everyone. And there can't be an adjective. There can't be Jewish ethics or Christian ethics or secular ethics. Either it's an ethical imperative or it's not an imperative. Right? That is definitely an opinion out there. I have mixed feelings about that. But in this case, all I'm trying to argue is that you have in this matter, Jewish ethics are being based on Jewish sources. It doesn't mean other traditions or sources or cultures can't relate to or resonate with those values as well. Right? And so that's how I sort of balance that issue. I am sympathetic to this idea, though, that if you think something's an ethical imperative, what does that have to do with being Jewish or not? But there's a much broader question whether halacha recognizes that, which relates to the Shiva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. And I don't know if I discuss this in a Torah Motion class. Maybe next time, maybe next session, we'll try to find another opportunity for that.
Do you think there's a machloket between Lieberman and Leibowitz?
I don't know. I gotta think about that. Okay. Rabbi Justin Kerber asks, I wonder about the limits of the imperative, be it halachic or moral. Suppose IDF creates a humanitarian corridor, but the besieged are reluctant to use it for fear of temporary refuge becoming permanent exile. Does the IDF have an obligation to provide a more appealing refuge? Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I was speaking about this, I don't remember who it was. A group of self-described, meaning by their own definition, they sort of describe themselves as nervous Zionists. They have a term they use for it. I forget what it was. Meaning they're Zionists, they're committed, but they're very nervous about a lot of ethical issues like this. And someone said to me, the fourth side open is just a way of ethnic cleansing. And I looked at them and said, why? Why? I said, listen, you're just trying to get rid of these people. So, the question you always have to ask is start with, first of all, do you think this war was a just cause or not? Right? Is there a just reason to go to war? So once you think that sort of removes a lot of those issues. And then the second issue, and this Rabbi Kerber, I think is the where it really gets to the core of the issue, is there are limits to what you can do, right, in order to help other people, right? In other words, I'm sympathetic to this issue because people will say, listen, these evacuation corridors aren't that appealing. Now, of course, part of the reason why they're not appealing in the case of Gaza is that the normal rules of war is that the neighboring countries are supposed to allow refugees in. Right? So in theory, that should have been happening here, right? The fact that the world is allowing Egypt to say, no, we're not taking them. No one said that about Syria, right, for example. And all of Europe has been transformed by having a million plus refugees come from Syria and other places. But so I do think that that's a part of the issue here. But at some point, there's a limit in my mind to what you can do, right? You are fighting war. And that's precisely what I was getting at beforehand. There are going to always be limit. I'm not saying that the fourth side open creates a paradise for everyone as the perfect solution. It's not. It's an attempt to try to minimize. But does not satisfy the requirements of a singular value framework. It doesn't set, if you build a framework of ethics that promotes only human rights and says human rights trumps everything, so you'd say, why do these individuals who didn't attack Israel, for example, why do they have to leave their homes? Why are they entitled to be attacked? And I think that's part of the moral complexity of all warfare, that those rights are being trumped by other considerations. But I do, if there was a more appealing refuge, then yeah, that would be something to consider. The question would be, what would that look like? I mean, let's take right now. I mean, I don't want to only tie this to contemporary events, but if there was an option to bring people to boats, which then take them to safety, right? There's ideas like this floated around at some point. I think Scotland said they would take in refugees from Gaza. And so let's say that was a political option. Okay, so you might say that Israel has an obligation to send the corridor towards the boats and to really let people get off to freedom. But we always have to be, we have the limits of reality as well. But it's a very good question, Rabbi Kirby. I appreciate it. Nancy Kaplan, the first Lebanon War, was there subsequent reevaluation of rabbinic approval for the operation? Once it became known that Sharon had misled Begin and the rest of the cabinet about it, or did that not really come out until after it's over? No, it came out already. It was sort of clear at the time that something had gone wrong. Of course, Begin resigns ultimately. Right? And so there is, things that go wrong here. It is very interesting what happens. So first of all, we have for the first time rabbinic protest against an Israeli war. You don't have that in 56, you don't have that in 67, you don't have the war of attrition, you don't have that in 73, you don't have the Litani operation, you don't have that in Entebbe, whatever. You don't have that in general. And suddenly you have significant figures who are coming out against them. What's most interesting to me is buried in Rav Goren's writings. Right? Rav Goren was a real supporter of the Lebanon War. Let's understand why. The Northern Galilee is being terrorized. Right? I mean, we've gotten used to this. It's so crazy we've gotten used to this, but right, they've been terrorized. And so he says this is a Milchamet Mitzvah, this is a war of self-defense. You gotta get rid of this terror from our southern, from our northern border. And but at some point, and this is such a crucial factor, and relevant as well now, even in the midst of wars, you cannot judge wars solely based on was the reason you what started the war in the first place legitimate. You always have to be evaluating throughout. Is this still a legitimate war, given the realities of what I can accomplish or can't accomplish? And Rav Goren at some point in, I think this is right after he stops being the chief rabbi, publishes an essay where he says, it could be at some point it stops being Milchamet Mitzvah. Right? And he sort of throws that in there. And I think that's a very, very important insight. And I think it goes both ways. So that, I don't want to get off track here, but the Chazon Ish has a very interesting statement where he says it could be you'd have a Milchamet Reshut, right? Discretionary war, which becomes obligatory because if it goes bad and backfires, and now you're under attack, well, once you're under attack, that becomes a Milchamet Mitzvah. Can it go both ways? I think the answer is yes. And one of the things I try to develop in the book is precisely this idea that you always have to be evaluating the justice of a war at different stages. I don't mean every single day you wake up, right? But in other words, you have to think a little bit broader strategy than that. But at different stages, you have to ask, right? Or can we still justify this given the goals, given not only the goals, but given the reality of what we can achieve or not? What happens a lot of times with countries is they don't do that. And that's when you get to Vietnam, Afghanistan, right? Other types of scenarios like this. Okay. And so it is crucial to do that. And I think that would be crucial today as well, for that matter. I don't mean literally today, but it could be we're at a crossroads right now. I mean, this is part of the dilemma I think the Israeli government now is facing, which is very hard for me to comment on because I don't feel like we really know all the information about what we know, what's going on, that's not being revealed to the public. But I think that we are probably at a crossroads right now. And that's just precisely when those questions have to be asked. Keeping in mind, of course, do we have another war coming up in Hezbollah in the north and all that? Great question, Nancy. Thank you. Harold Pearl asks, is every psak or halacha morally correct? Harold, you're making me work here now. This is a big topic. Yeah, so we do have notions of lifnei mishurat hadin. We do have supererogatory behavior. The reason why I think lifnei mishurat hadin is a problematic principle in these circumstances is because in lifnei mishurat hadin, frequently when you go above and beyond, there's not a real moral cost to it. You weren't obligated to return an object. You do it anyway. Lifnei mishurat hadin. So you lost out on something, right? But there wasn't any extra suffering here. When it comes to these war cases of warfare, an extra amount of humanitarianism might mean you don't have decisive victory. And so it's hard to know exactly how to apply a concept of lifnei mishurat hadin when precisely in that moment you're balancing conflicting values. And so, I think it's complex here. And certainly, I don't think everything is morally correct, though. Meaning, I think one of the things we can and should do is, can you argue with people within this framework, right? There are times when people say to me, let's say someone would say to me, it is a moral obligation to do everything at all costs to get the captives home. And you can invoke halachic sources for that. And I could invoke halachic sources back and say, no, right, the obligation should be on military victory and this, and worrying about the klal, the tzibor, and less priority over the individuals. So you could argue and say one is morally correct and not correct here, but I do think those are both ethically cogent principles. It's ethically cogent to make such a statement. And that is what I think this framework tries to set up. I think, by the way, you can apply that to many other disagreements in halacha, which also touch on ethical matters. End of life care, of course, being one of them, but many, many other areas as well. But that's a short answer to a much broader question, but a very important and good question, Harold. Thank you. Go ahead.
One also could apply that to torture of a captain and getting information from a prisoner. So again, you have where, either both sides have cause to say their ethical reasons for doing both ways, and saying there's a limit to how much you can torture somebody, and two, or you can say, no, we need to find out because somebody's life is at stake or many people's lives are at stake. What I was making was that it's hard to make a discrete decree about anything, and that you have to take moral values into account as you make those decisions.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree with that. And so people sometimes say back to me, "Was that mean a relativistic?" I said, "No, I'm not being relativistic. Meaning, by what I'm trying to argue is that case by case, we're going to have legitimate disagreements about which ethical values take priority in these circumstances. And what makes someone a fundamentalist, in my mind, is when you only think in terms of one value." Right? And that is where the danger of fundamentalism comes into play, is that, and you can see this on the left and the right in different directions and whatnot, that when you take into only one account, say, this is the only thing that matters. And I give a list of other values that seem to make a lot of sense to me and seem to be, good moral appeals can be made to them. And so I'm like, no, those are totally legitimate. That's where I feel like you get into the problematic situation. I have a very hard time arguing with people in those circumstances. Because I don't feel that, we're talking the same plane. And the torture example is a great one. I wrote about this somewhere, actually. I don't remember where, but, and not in the book. It's, but I don't know, somewhere, Google Shlomo Brody torture. You understand what I mean by that. It's okay. Yes. I hope listening to Shlomo Brody is not torture. Okay. Ben asks, Hamas control the field in which the war is to be played. The only way to protect the maximum number of civilians would be used infantry only without any explosive weapons. This would result in unacceptable casualties amongst the IDF. I agree 100%, Ben. Right? And that is why you're balancing different values. And one of the big debates that took place in 2006 and 2008 was precisely over force protection. How far do we go in order to make sure we don't overly endanger our soldiers? And when push comes to shove, my feeling is that we should be prioritizing force protection, but we're going to have to figure that out sort of case by case. But that is my feeling on it. Michael Walzer had a very public debate with Asa Kasher. Asa Kasher is one of the leading Israeli ethicists, and Walzer is a great American ethicist, and you can read about it in the New York Review of Books and hold back and forth and discuss at length in the book as well. Nancy, if one concludes that a military response is just, then does it mean that's a free-for-all? No, I don't think so. There are two separate categories, very, very important. There's the just of what's the ethics of going to war, and there's the ethics of how we fight war. And one of the reasons why we distinguish the two, I mean, obviously, if you think what you're doing is a totally unjust war, you're going to be very, very judgmental of all killing that goes on in that war because you're not sympathetic to it. But if we would operate that way, we can never function because everyone thinks they're fighting a just war. Almost everyone thinks just war. In fact, by the way, Memory translated an interview with one of the senior Hamas officials. I think it was with Russian TV. And his argument about October 7th is very si simple. Everything we do is just because we are the suppressed. And so nothing we can do is not just. So, once you take it that way, you realize that if we want to be cheerleaders and just root on our side, then of course, yeah, we can say that. But if you think that it's ethics, and Gershon, this relates to your point, right, about ethics applying to others as well. So you'd have to apply in both directions. Milchama Mitzvah, Milchama Rishut, Rabbi Kerber. If you look in Google search sources journal, I try to explicate it out for a bit there as well, in terms of figuring this out. And a last question, I think, before I lose my voice. Daniel, if halacha equals some kind of international norm, what is the added value of halacha? Are we just saying the approaches follow general ethics, which, of course, is open to many different interpretations? So I don't think halacha equals international norm. That is precisely actually what Rabbi Israeli argued in many ways. In which he says is that whatever the international norm of how it is practiced, not how it is on paper, but how it is on practice, right? As reciprocity is very important, is all that halacha demands, for better or for worse. And part of my belief is that the sources of Judaism can help us build out an ethical framework, which is not just about international norms. It's what we think is right. I have actually little respect for international law. I don't mean maritime law, right? In terms of, but in terms of international law bodies, I have little respect for what's become of it. And I think the recent incidents in The Hague have only proved this point to a greater extent. But ideas of ethics that are propagated in international law, I think should be taken seriously. But that doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything in terms of, those matters. And we can reasonably disagree and argue for what we think is to be true. And precisely for that reason is why I wrote the book, is that I was trying to create a situation where rabbinic writings over the last 100 years have not been in conversation with general ethical discourse. Right? They're written in Hebrew and rabbinic jargon. With very little reference to that. It implicitly, you can see sometimes people are referring to it, but it's not in deep conversation. And part of the goal of the book of Ethics of Our Fighters is to create that conversation to create an ethical framework. And I think sometimes halacha can give us a real psak do and don't do, and that's very important. So that's true in ritual areas, and that can be true in many other areas as well, and many, many, many areas. But sometimes I think halacha's gift is to give us a framework, a halachic framework, for trying to figure out the appropriate behavior. Okay, I'll pull it in here. We finished our three sessions now, so thank you all so much for joining, and welcome to follow up, brody@amatai.org.
Would you be
And
willing to share your email address with us?
absolutely, absolutely. I'm putting in the chat is brody@amatai.org.
Thank you.
Pleasure. And I look forward to being in touch. All the best.